Great Migrations, another few other tales that I'll tell you. If you're interested in what we are doing in Stockholm, please look at the this address from which you'll get to the our groups page. And I'll just jump to the brief mention of who's there and interested in planets. So we have observers who do very relevant work on dusty disks, Beta Pictoris, and other objects like Titauri stars. And I've been recently blessed to be a coordinator of a whole European Union program. So I'm like in charge of observers in the former Soviet Union. This is interesting. Who are going to observe photometry, spectroscopy, and polarimetry of Titauri, supposedly disks, to try to find the density waves, objects, perturbers, anything periodic in their variability. And some of the variability has already been found. So Yesta Gam is interested in that very much. Others are observing dusty disks in various techniques, and Ray mentioned already Alexis, who just graduated. And they have observed the gas subdisks in Beta Pictoris and determined their rotation, and they are beautiful, you know, hundreds of AU and pretty puffed up, surprisingly thick configuration as well. Now, theory group is participating in EU RTN Research and Training Network, Planets something something. I don't remember exactly the title, but again, I'm supposed to be in charge of these younger people. We have two postdocs just arrived from Cambridge, Richard Edgar and Eduardo Delgado. By the way, they are color-coded by how green they are, you see. these people. So we have also graduate students, Adam, Anna, and Miguel, and we have finishing undergraduates who do their diploma thesis. And this is about what we do, as you might imagine, planet disk interaction, dusty disks, some other ideas like model analysis of the edges of the disk, which are sometimes susceptible to vortex formation and other instabilities, and a numerical comparison project that I'll mention in the following. I should mention here that, because I won't be showing any viewgraphs of this, because Ray, I think, mentioned that it's a good idea to look at dust to try to determine the amount of gas in the system, because gas is very hard to observe itself, especially in those inclined systems where you don't see the star through the disk, like in Beta Pic. But we started with Beta Pic and looked at this idea of determining the amount of gas in Beta Pic theoretically rather than observationally and comparing. Because there is a great dichotomy. There are conflicting observations. There's a conflict by a factor of, I guess, more than 100 about the presence of molecular hydrogen in Beta Pictoris. So what about theory? Theory should be very useful in that respect. If you make a model and you put a lot of gas, by a lot I mean 60 Earth masses total in a big disk like Beta Pictoris, then the dust dynamics will be affected a lot. And the dust will do strange things. And it won't be able to stay on the orbits like it we think is staying in the Beta Pictoris disk. And that was the result that Ganya obtained. She actually studied the vertical evolution of the dust. If you have gas in the system with this higher amount that was claimed a couple of years back, ISO observations, then the dust would flatten into a Saturn ring-like very thin configuration. There's no way to kick it up efficiently back up. But if the amount is small, like the other observations are showing, then it's okay and it can stay and it can migrate slowly. So topic number one is actually we are trying to think about the dusty disks in a way of explaining some structure, and also I already talked about the gas contents. Structure can be induced by various things like gas dust coupling that causes migration of dust. So this is the first of these great migrations. Dust can migrate in such a disk like this one from this point to this point in no time at all, by which I mean just dozens of orbital periods or less, depending on its size, if it's affected by radiation pressure and gas drag at the same time. So I want to explain this because that's already a paper published already in 2001 with Takeuchi. The structures formed in this way are more or less axisymmetric, though. And that's not what you see here. So there could be perturbations, or there could be perhaps. We have to check this. We still don't have the answer, but we're advancing and modeling dust avalanches. What's a dust avalanche? Imagine that you have two planetesimals colliding somewhere in a disk and creating a little cloud of dust. Suppose it's somewhere here or somewhere here. And then the cloud of dust contains a lot of area and submicron grains, which are propelled by radiation pressure very efficiently. So they try to escape. They gain a lot of energy when they accelerate, and they're accelerated by radiation pressure. And on the way out, a certain fraction of them, depending on the optical thickness of this thing, which is a few percent probably, so a few percent of them strike other grains and break them apart. So you build an avalanche, an exponential thing, which may actually, in some conditions, become visible on the outskirts of a disk. And it is bent and so on, but no one cared about the spatial and temporal dependence of this, because these kind of view graphs I was showing for years, but we never cared about how these things might look. But now we are doing this kind of work where radiation pressure is responsible for the whole bunch of processes and a lot of processes in these dusty disks. So there is another work on HR4796, this ringy system, where we are asking the question of how similar it is to Beta Peak and whether it has to have gas or can it be like very, very low gas system. And the way to study this is to assume that there is no gas or very, very little gas and try to see what happens to dust. And dust is actually affected so much by radiation pressure that erosion is enhanced by the radiation pressure induced effects so much that you get, from a full model like this, you get the following strange results. This is just a line of theoretical models, depending on how much dust you put into the disk. That's measured by the ratio of infrared luminosity to the bolometric luminosity. So what part of escaping stellar radiation is absorbed by dust, essentially. And that's the log of it. So beta peak, in beta peak, it's something like 2 times 10 to minus 3. That part of radiation is absorbed and re-emitted in infrared. So that's a beta peak amount of dust. HR is not that much different geometrically. It's also broad. It's a ring of material. Beta peak can be seen, in some sense, as a broad ring of material with the same size, actually. So it's just 3 times more dusty. So it's to the right of this model. Now, what this thick line shows is the calculated destruction time, but not of the dust that we currently see. It's the destruction time of the full amount of dust and solids in a typical planetary system, which is estimated to be 120 Earths. So it takes only 10 to 100 million years. In this model, it takes only 65 million years to grind, to dust and eject this amount of solids. And that was always kind of very close to the estimated age of Beta Peak. And mind you, the age of the Beta Peak moved a little bit toward the lower boundary of it on my figure, which is old. So everything is okay because Beta Peak in the theoretical model seems to grind the dust at the rate which is not in conflict with its age. However, HR4796 in this gas-free model is the opposite. It would grind the dust so fast that an equivalent of solar system amount of solids would be gone in just 2 million years or so. So that's the way we just have to publish this and so on. And that's, I've described this in words, okay? Now, to the second topic, which is another type of great migrations, which is migration of big things in disks. Now, of course, I don't have to tell you all the story because you've seen this kind of diagram, a joint theory for type 1 and type 2 migration. Type 1 is without the gap and type 2 is with the gap or inside the gap. And the physics of it depends really on one thing only, that disks spit out or repel planets. You know, whether or not you have a big gap or just a small dip, everything depends on the fact that each side of the disk tries to get rid of the planet, tries to push the planet away. And which one wins in the type 1, it's a matter of calculation that's been done, and migration is inward, is rather fast, and so on and so on. You know the story. Type 2 is the same thing. There's a planet in the gap, and the edges of the gap push away the planet. That's the normal shepherding. If that works like that, we have fast migration times. If, however, something else happens and disks really work differently, at least some disks. Could you say again? What is the gap? I'll show you a gap. This is a gap. You have a disk which is disrupted by a planet. The planet forms a low density ring around it. That's what I mean by gap. Right? Ooh. Okay. So now, there is a possibility, however, that the physics of the interaction is opposite of that. And disks actually suck in and attract planets. And this is associated with the concept of co-rotational resonance or co-rotational torques. It's a better expression. And this is the usually understood in terms, analyzed in terms of Lindblad resonances. So there's a migration mode which is quite opposite to everything in the past, and it's been co-discovered by myself and by Frederic Masset. But it was actually first seen before it was discovered. The first time it was seen was something like 1993 or 4, when Willy Klei visited me and we worked on migration and we implemented my routines to calculate the evolution into his code. And we saw that some planets were dropping onto stars like stones. So Willy was very dissatisfied with me and he said that my routines suck. And I thought his code sucks because I couldn't find any error in my routines. And Frederic Masset also told me similar stories that he didn't believe in the beginning in what he was seeing in numerical experiments. But because this type of migration is very fast. Okay, I'll skip that. So what are the theoretical expectations? Should we expect the Lindblad resonances or co-rotational resonances to win? Well, from some of the existing works, you see that in the standard first-order perturbation theory, where planet is fixed on its circular orbit, perturbations are infinitesimal. So we can Fourier analyze, Fourier synthesize things, and so on and so on. Some assumptions are involved, definitely. Even then, the differential Lindblad torque is not way larger than the differential co-rotational torque. And we find in numerical calculations like these ones, let's say this is my... Well, the sign is such that it should produce inward migration from Lindblads and outward migration from co-rotations, let's say. So you can you know.
Total positive there means what?
Total positive means inward migration. The outer disk wins. The Lindblad resonance is in the outer disk wins, essentially. Okay, so now to numerical codes, because for years and years, again, maybe 5 years, I've been telling the audiences at conferences that this is a very nice theory, but unfortunately, none of the numerical experiments are able to confirm it if you relax some of these assumptions, like you make your planet mobile. The planets don't want to obey these migration laws. This is a variable resolution code, so it has high resolution here and a lower resolution somewhere else, but it's not multi-grid, for instance. It's PPM. We have now like seven different codes to study this problem. AMR is being used. Flash has been adapted. In both in my group and in the Warsaw node of the European network, maybe some other people also work with Flash. Yeah, SPH. I haven't seen anything recent, but yeah. Okay, yeah, I'm not checking this so frequently. But I'll just show you know, this is the kind of things that this is the state of the art in numerics. In 2D calculations, you can now resolve if this is unit distance here between the planet and the star. You go down 4 levels of refinement, so you have like 5-level calculation. And you go down to the resolution where your pixels are like 10 to minus 3 of the distance. So why do we need this? It actually turns out this is the PowerPoint. Sorry?
Did that allow the planet to
move? Yeah. It's not fixed. Fixing a planet influences the result. It predetermines the result, pretty much. Okay, so... This is my learning PowerPoint is very useful. It gives you hints of what to say and so on. Okay, so before I show you the movies of how planets migrate, which are very nice, keep in mind that there are big troubles in this world. Resolution is a headache. We can't get enough of it. We can't get convergence with the resolutions when we increase it of our results. We can't get agreement between the different codes. Things depend on gravitational softening a lot. Things depend on arbitrary neglect of torques from certain regions, like people do often to avoid other numerical problems. So gravity is almost always missing. Gas heating and other effects influence the results quite a bit, and so on and so on. So I invite everybody working with numerical codes to look at this page. Or you can get there somehow through this and then click on several things. This is a comparison problem. We have already the input, the data, in a certain format for a certain test problem with the Jupiter inserted into a flat disk and so on and so on and so on a fixed orbit, to be simple. And we invite everybody to do this. We'll have a mini workshop. And some people from US participate this, and a lot of these people gathered in the European network. An example of what I mean by trouble and by differences, you see a smooth disk from a Zeus code, and you see something very funny from a PPM code.
What version?
Okay, Yeah, that's from Lubo et al., 1999.
That's actually MHD.
It's actually switched off.
No,
it's no MHD here. Right. Oh, by the way, PPM also has magnetic fields, but we are too afraid to switch them on at the moment.
Magnetic fields can only help.
Yeah.
Sorry, what is the difference?
Yeah, well, you see, there are lots of differences. Here, what I'm pointing to is the very different structure in the whole outer disk. Not so much in the inner, but the outer disk has this filamentary thing. And, you know, it just may be, maybe nothing bad about the code or something. It may be an actual physical growing mode where waves a little bit are bouncing, although we have this great effort to have calculations with non-bouncing conditions, with where waves are going out and are being absorbed rather than bouncing back. So we do everything possible. We don't see these waves bouncing back, but still, I don't know. We have to understand this, whether this is some effect of growing mode and waves bouncing back and forth in this outer disk, which is relatively narrow in this calculation, or...
Same grid?
No. It's actually... There are differences because these are completely different algorithms. And this was R-Phi code, right, Steve? This is a XY, inertial frame, square grid code. Yeah, certainly, because in an R-Phi code, you always have to evacuate. You have to have a finite radius. In X-Y code, you can avoid that by just softening the star sufficiently, and then you can go down with your see spirals going down quite nicely. So now it would take an hour to explain all the possible differences that we see between the codes, between different coordinate systems with one algorithm and so on. But the way to go is probably to do this comparison and then to wonder why we get these differences. There are codes like the CLAW pack, which produce quite different results yet, and quite unbelievable, I would say, but maybe we implement it in some wrong way or something. Okay, so now, go back to this and click on it. So that's how migration works. So you may have seen this. If you do this in a low resolution calculation and just do the softening but count all the torques on a core that moves, the planet tends to migrate in, and it migrates at a rate which is different than the expectations from... It is wobbling a little, but that... In some of these calculations, the planet is so massive that if you start it, there's a problem of starting a planet because sometimes you need to introduce it slowly over several periods. And then the star gets like a kick and you have some initial eccentricity. However, then it actually can grow during the calculation. But it's not a big wobble. The eccentricity is never growing above maybe 2% or 3%, something like that. Yeah. Now, if you only introduce the inner disk, that's the gas here, and that's almost vacuum here, and you let the planet evolve, what it does is transfers the matter along the horseshoe orbits from the inner disk to the outer disk. And since something moves out, something has to move in to conserve angular momentum, and that something that moves in is a planet. So you see a little bit of inward migration. So the disk doesn't repel this planet, although it should strongly repel, according to Lindblad torques. It actually starts sucking it in. What causes the stopping of migration in this case is that the mass of this disk is not sufficient to support it. For type 3 migration, you need relatively massive disk, meaning, in practical terms, several times the minimum solar nebula. Otherwise, the co-rotational region of the disk is much less massive than the planet itself. And then the planet is not pushed by the flow of matter.
Sorry, I have a type 3 migration. Is this what you call type 3?
Yeah. That's a type 3 because you'll see it more clearly in the next one, where I have only the outer disk, and so it continues a little more. The conditions in this disk favor continued migration outward. And the timescale in orbits, in initial orbits, is shown in the corner. And you'll see that this is a rather fast process. So again, the matter from the outside is shuffled to the inside. It partially fills the inner void. That's an artificial condition, of course, but it just shows you the basic process, that if you start with evacuated inner disk, with the big imbalance, the Lindblad resonances would like to push this planet inside, but they are not winning. Co-rotations are much stronger. They initiate the outward migration, and then it keeps going. This planet actually is plowing into the uniform density disk, and that's a kind of a disk where if you introduce the planet in that disk somewhere far out, it would normally try to go in. But in this calculation, it goes out. That's just a little more massive version of a disk of the previous calculation. So you see, the rate and the direction of migration depends not only on the local conditions in the disk and the planet properties. It depends on the previous history. So things get quite complicated. The first disk was, I think, 1 or 1.5 times the minimum solar nebula kind of density around the Jupiter mass planet. The other one was several times higher.
There's no self-gravity.
There's no self-gravity of gas in this. They both are just a few times minimum solar nebula. So the usual argument is that you don't need it. However, it may not be true. In the very end, I feel that self-gravity will be important, but in a subtle way, around the planet. It may cause a subtle, things that are... You cross the instability of the envelope mass, 8 Earth masses or 10. That's my idea how this can happen. And I have, actually here somewhere I have the calculations. The gap will be produced by that planet.
No, but if you didn't have a gap, you wouldn't have
that. Yeah, that's a very good question. So while I'm answering it, wait a minute. I'll just run the simulation with the whatever. This is the AMR calculation now. The question is whether, in the case where this core mass is low enough so you don't have a clear gap, whether you can ever have such an imbalance of torques initially to start the type 3 migration. And we don't know the answer to that problem, and that's why we are here, some of us, thinking about this problem, whether type 1 migration is not subject to such a conceptual change as type 2, because my simulations are more like type 2, of course, situation. But it may be, because co-rotational torques are potentially more powerful than Lindblads. In any case, even in the case of a smooth disk, completely smooth disk of a low-mass planet. So usually the estimates were showing, but they were a bit of like wishful thinking, and also, you know, there are all these assumptions like fixed orbit of a planet, and the mobility of the planet wasn't taken into account in these estimates. So now we are trying to figure out, and I guess Gordon and Steve and I are thinking about in terms of orbits and trajectories in the system. Well, Steve can say more about these because he knows. They're beginning to come online. You know, but the resolution is still a big problem for 3D.
Well,
Right. So that agrees with the analytical theory, which also assumes a fixed orbit planet. Yeah.
But that was my question also. In any of these numerical simulations, you don't always take a snapshot, calculate the force, and see whether they agree with the communication theory. You've actually done that for fixed.
Right. That's what we do on a fixed orbit, but not here, because the analytical theory usually just neglects any eccentricity, and there is a little eccentricity here. So, I mean, and also the torques vary with time, as you can see here. There is no time stationarity of flow. That's another surprising thing that we never achieve in the high-resolution codes, the stationarity. So. There is a region of orbits which circle around, librate, and that powers this migration.
I would presume if you have multiple planets, that can complicate things.
That complicates things even further. I don't know if we necessarily need that at this point, but I'm trying to understand what's happening to one planet. But certainly, Frédéric Massey already put two planets. That's where he started. Yeah, that's where he started, actually. He started with two planets which were trying to get into a resonance, and then he saw some strange things which he later interpreted as type 3 migration at work. And these two planets were traveling outward. That was the big surprise.
The interaction between them was very interesting.
Right. Well, there'll be an added resonant effect between them, probably. But yeah, well, you can think of a smooth disk. In a smooth disk, these two planets will just interact in some complicated way, probably get into a resonance, or at least periodically they will get into a resonance, trying to get away and then coming back together and so on. These kind of, they'll move in a coordinated way. So, the time non-stationarity is shown in this movie. This is just around the planet. This is the initial transient, which is not so important. That's orbits, actually, Jupiter years or something. And if you look at that, it's not a very stationary thing, and that's very typical of all high-resolution codes, which don't impose any added high-level viscosity. Because with the enough viscosity, you can smooth the flow and achieve like very nice streamlines, no wobbling, and so on. But you need alpha 10 to minus 2 for that. All right, let's just see. Sorry? Oh, yeah, these are shocks. These are these things that you were seeing here. Oh, maybe not here, but in this one. There's a complicated set of shocks. As you can see, maybe I'll stop it so it doesn't wobble so much. This part resembles a little bit a bow shock because material is coming from the inner disk and hitting it at high speed. And here, and that is a continuation of it. But you can see how many intersecting shocks there are in this region where row slope size is this 0.07. So Lagrange point would be somewhere here, and you have at least three types of shocks there, and there's a spiral going in down to the very planet, which is at this part these torques from this spiral are very important, and this is not a tidally induced M equal 2 spiral. It also is connected with the kinematics of incoming flow. It's more, it has something to do with it, like a bow shock again, but there's several shocks through which the gas goes.
But that torque affects the accretion flow.
Right. Well, in this calculation, there's no accretion allowed, I should say. But if you allow accretion, you can get quite a high rate.
So what's your boundary condition?
It's just a softened point mass.
Oh, okay, so the flow goes through the soft.
It has to avoid the center. There's an some kind of unnatural rotation rate at the very center, no accretion is allowed. Everything has to go back out of the rush lobe.
And what's the size of that subtension?
It's usually people were using 0.2 times the rush lobe, but we find that it's actually you need to make it much smaller and have much higher resolution to achieve any kind of unique answer to your migration question. The direction of migration can depend on these details, not only the speed, but in the case of a flat disk, this is a nasty case where things are canceling on two sides. And right, with 5-6 levels, you reach the cell size is about the physical size of a planet. But to really resolve things, you would need even much more, and that's a problem. Already, my graduate student worked for months to implement time step individual on different levels, which is not in the original flash code, and that slows down the whole calculation. You can afford easily 10 levels memory-wise, but the time step from the 10th level will stop your calculation, and you won't be able to get anywhere. So, and this code has to be parallel, and so there are these technical reasons why people don't really want to go beyond like 5 or 6 levels, and they're not very keen on resolving continents on the planet or something like this. Although it would be possible, strictly speaking, for a short time. Okay, so let me see. I probably don't want to bore you with the... If you ever want to know how this works, just come to me and see these things, because I have these neat models of why this migration continues and what powers it and so on. It depends on the fact that there are these close orbits behind the planet. Planet is carrying away with itself a region of low density of gas, like a vacuum bubble that carries it, because there's more material in front of this planet, so it pulls it forward and the planet migrates out in this case. And it's just the opposite. If the migration is inward, you see the vacuum bubble on the other side, and it's just the opposite of this thing. So there are all these neat things, but let me close with the question of what that really means for planet formation. The timescales associated with this type 3 migration are ridiculously short, as you have seen. So does that mean that all the planets have to travel through disks and get very close to the stars or fall into the stars or what? Well, if the disks are power law, although it's still technically speaking an open question, but I think that it will be resolved in favor of the answer which is yes. If you have a very smooth disk and nothing, and the conditions in the disk, like the amount of mass in the co-rotational region and so on, are sufficient, you could just travel long way in short time. But what I'm counting on is the non-power law structure of real disks. We see that disks have structure already in these transitional systems that we look at by looking at dust. And also the idea of the dead zone, which should induce enhanced density, photoevaporation from inside, photoevaporation from outside, some other reasons that we don't know of, because we don't have 100% understanding of what's causing the effect of viscosity in disks. But none of these mechanisms are guaranteed to work from radius zero to radius infinity in a uniform way, power law way. So if disks have structure, have ridges, have density gradients, these are the places where planet migration stops or reverses, actually. If the planet migrates through the high density region and finds itself on the inner edge, it then has the conditions for what I was showing in this exaggerated calculation, where there is almost nothing inside and then something outside. So it really stops migrating there. Where that happens depends on the disk, and that can be anywhere, like the distances the extrasolar planets have. They are everywhere. They don't all seem to go very close to the star and stop there. There is no, that would cause a huge pileup of planets probably at the periods between 3 and 10 days or something like that. And there is maybe a little pileup, but I don't believe there is a huge pileup. So why do they stop? There's this question, why do they stop at 40-day periods and 100-day periods? And just maybe there were edges, there were density gradients in the disk there, which is actually what the people working on the dead zones propose. So that's it. I won't show you any other things. The thing I want to work on is just the kind of new perturbation theory, which doesn't assume circular unperturbed orbits. You see, that's the kind of perturbation theory we always had for Lindblad resonances, for other things. You send the particle on an unperturbed straight orbit, which in these local coordinates would be a straight line from top to bottom, and you do infinitesimal perturbations on it and see how it wobbles after passing the planet. But the real trajectories of gas are more like these things, what I call still toy models, because I simplify equations to get these streamlines. But they resemble quite well what gas does. And now I have simple analytical expressions for these streamlines and all this. And I'm hoping to, while here, to do the perturbation theory on these much more realistic orbits to effectively get something like what you would call Lindblad torques in this region and co-rotational asymmetries in this region. And maybe that will be some kind of unified theory will allow the calculation some of these migration rates, which are pretty much numerical at this point, we should realize. And numerics is fallible. So that's my plan for it. Thanks.